Frank Douglas has had a very distinguished career in life sciences. As CSO of Avantis, two-time winner of Global Pharmaceutical Director of the Year Award, he's on the board of Medtronics, has been on the Scientific Advisory Board of FDA, long list. Frank is now leading MIT's newly formed Biomedical Innovation Center. Frank will pose to us the clear challenge of escalating R&D costs that are untamed by present technologies. So the question is, can you benefit from the global forces?
Good morning. It's indeed very difficult to follow pearls of wisdom. There's just one pearl after another. And certainly as I sat there, I began reflecting on some of the lessons that I have learned. And I'd like to share perhaps three of them with you before I actually get into my prepared thoughts. And those three lessons are the following. One has to do with outsourcing. For many years, when I was a head of R&D, we had a collaboration with Dow Pharmaceuticals in Chengdu, China. And I had many fights with my chemists in particular, who really did not want to do natural products chemistry. It was much easier to do combinatorial chemistry and to do computer-aided design, whether you understood the target or not. So one day I finally decided the way to get around this was to really focus on something on which we could all agree, and that is, instead of really trying to find the active principle that will be a winner in traditional Chinese medicines, why don't we focus on trying to find novel scaffolds, chemical diversity? And everyone signed on to that. So we geared the outsourcing, if you like, around that. And as time went on, it became clearer and clearer to me how much we were really missing by not fully utilizing the talents of our Chinese colleagues. Because more and more we prescribed what they should do in order to avoid their getting IP. A second lesson that I reflected on as Howard was speaking was the frustration that I had with new technologies. My scientists could always justify why a new technology used within its particular silo was going to increase the productivity of what we were doing within that silo, but could never answer the question as to whether that particular technology, when used within the suite of technologies that were focused either at target ID validation or at lead optimization, etc., would actually increase productivity over time frame and for that target of events. The third and the most recent that I was reflecting on is my move to MIT to set up the MIT Center for Biomedical Innovation, whose mission is to bring together scientists from academia, industry, and government to work on areas that we all know are really barriers to increasing innovation and productivity. And one of the things I've learned since being there is that indeed my frustration that we were doing R&D in a sort of a silo modular fashion rather than a systems approach is indeed a correct notion. And what I also begin to realize right now is that, as a matter of fact, as you said, Howard, you can't change the past. And so, in a real sense, many of our scientists who were not brought up thinking in systems, thinking systems biology, etc., it's very difficult to change them to move forward. But we've had a wonderful experience. And that experience is a course which we introduced this spring, which is called Case Studies in Drug Discovery and Development, in which we invite senior scientists from industry to present a product, on the market or a field effort to illustrate either challenges in target ID, target validation, challenges in doing clever clinical trials, regulatory hurdles, etc. And then we challenged teams of the students to take each of these projects, each of these compounds, and identify how they would solve those problems given current technologies and methodologies that may not have been available at the time these scientists in the companies were addressing those problems. And we have been just extraordinarily astounded at some of the novel ideas that have emanated from these students. In fact, my colleague Tony Sinski says to me all the time, these young students are my hope for the pharmaceutical industry. So with that as a backdrop, I think you will understand why I make the comments I will present to you. So first, let me thank the organizers of TICON for inviting me to participate in this very provocative and timely discussion. This is truly a topic of world significance, and I think one that challenges fundamental beliefs. It is, in my view, similar to the impact that Copernicus and Galileo had in challenging man's view of himself within the cosmos, while eventually enabling a remarkable advance in science that led to wonderful discoveries, voyages, and products that only became possible once it was accepted that a physical Earth was not flat. For today's discussion, we claim that the world is flat. This seeming paradox is best represented in this cartoon. It's up there, thanks. One demonstration that the physical Earth is not flat is that as we look at a sailboat disappearing in the distance, first the hull disappears, then finally the mast. In a flat world, we see the entire boat as it disappears from view. There is no iceberg effect. The view remains a holistic one as long as the boat is visible. It is precisely in this sense that information technology and ease of travel have made our world flat. We can see further, understand deeper, and react faster. As in the time of Copernicus and Galileo, this will challenge cherished beliefs, enable new discoveries and products, and ultimately further improve the well-being of all mankind. Let me now comment on the reality of diseases in a flat world. First, let me quote from Dr. Robert Weinstein's perspective on planning for epidemics, which he wrote in the June 2nd, 2004 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. In the terms of sheer drama, the emergence of the severe acute respiratory syndrome, namely SARS, rivaled the most exotic micro-Christian thriller. A novel viral strain spread in wet markets from an obscure animal to food handlers, through a rural province in southern China to Hong Kong, by way of an ill Chinese physician who had traveled to attend a wedding, and in one night at a Hong Kong hotel, from that man to at least 12 other people. These 12 returned to their 5 home countries and created multiple chains of transmission that, over the course of the next 4 months, led to more than 8,000 cases of SARS, resulting in almost 800 deaths in 27 countries, representing every continent. The lessons of SARS are strong and clear and will influence the preparedness planning for epidemics for at least the next several years. First, animal pathogens, whether SARS-associated coronavirus, West Nile virus, monkeypox virus, avian influenza virus, or the prion agent of bovine spongiform encephalopathy, that is mad cow disease, can pose major risks to human health. Second, with modern transportation and communication, a problem affected a remote province of China one day can become everyone's problem the next day. Third, the capabilities of molecular virology are tremendous. Within a matter of weeks, the coronavirus that causes SARS was identified, the sequence of the genetic backbone determined. Fourth, the epidemiological histories alone were sufficient to permit the chains of SARS transmission to be traced. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the World Health Organization, and local public health agencies worked together well to create the necessary surge capacity. Basic infection control measures worked well, although SARS is particularly unforgiving when there are lapses in adherence or in laboratory biosafety. Finally, and perhaps most striking, one person can have an enormous impact, whether the ill physician who's traveled from Guangdong province to Hong Kong resulted in a pandemic, or the ill physician, Dr. Carlo Orbani, who alerted the world health community to the SARS epidemic, but ultimately died from the disease. Let's look at HIV/AIDS. It is generally believed that HIV is the result of zoonosis, that is, the crossing over of simian immunodeficiency virus from monkeys to humans. This viral transfer is felt to have occurred from hunters killing and eating infected monkeys. Whether that's the origin or not is debated. However, what is clear is that truckers and others visiting infected prostitutes in Africa, international travel by gay young men during the 70s and 80s, as well as the sharing of needles among drug users, and the use of infected blood for transfusions or for the extraction of factor VIII to treat hemophiliacs, have all contributed to the spread of this disease. The December 2002 AIDS epidemic update estimated that of the 42 million adults and children living with HIV/AIDS, more than 29 million were in sub-Saharan Africa, 6 million in South and Southeast Asia, 1.5 million in Latin America, 1 million in North America, 1.7 million in Eastern, Central, and Western Europe, and 1.2 million in East Asia and the Pacific. They also reported increasing prevalence in women and children. One good comment of note in this report was the promising result of stabilization of the incidence of HIV in countries such as Ethiopia, Uganda, and Zambia due to treatment and prevention programs. I'd like to mention one other disease category, namely cardiovascular, which is impacted by a combination of genetic predisposition and environmental lifestyle factors. Obesity prevalence in the U.S. continues to increase, ranging from an increase of 14.4% between 1976 and 1980 to an increase of 30.5% from 1999 to 2000. This is generating a growing concern that the incidence of type 2 or adult onset diabetes in children and young adults will increase. A clear concern in a flat world is that environmental factors such as change in diet, lack of exercise, which is one of the consequences of the IT revolution, will create an epidemic. Now, let us turn to innovating new therapies for such diseases in a flat world. The outstanding success in controlling SARS was a combination of application of public health and rapid application of technologies to identify and hence diagnose the agent and treat as well as prevent the disease. This will undoubtedly be the recipe for success for all diseases that have an environmental component. However, for all diseases, the need to identify causality, mechanism of action to diagnose, prevent, and treat will remain an ever-present priority. Presently, we bemoan the lack of ability to use new knowledge and technologies to deliver rapid diagnoses and therapeutic solutions that are free of side effects. Nonetheless, we can envision the day when personalized or patient group tailored medicines will be readily available. We can envision that patients will be assessed for individual risk and will be diagnosed early when biochemical dysregulation is present, although no physiological or functional impairment can as yet be measured. Why is this vision not yet achievable? To answer this, we must understand the way in which drug discovery is prosecuted. Historically, that is pre-1980s, the predominant approach to discovering drugs was physiologically based. Probe compounds were tried in animal models of a disease, and potential candidates were chemically optimized through a trial and error method, or at best, through recognition of the pharmacores, that is, the elements of the structure that are required for activity. The 1980s saw the introduction of mechanism-based drug discovery, in which 1 to 3 targets were identified as potentially relevant for the disease. Molecules were screened against these targets. Active molecules were then tested, and if found to be active in tissue and animal models, the target was felt to have been validated as having relevance for the disease. This approach was ideally suited for the use of technologies such as high-throughput screening and combinatorial chemistry, whereas the physiological-based approach was clearly of low throughput. Between these two methodologies is the function-based approach. In this method, compounds are screened for impact of a function that may be present in both diseased and controlled cells or tissues, and which function is correlated with the disease. The genomics and proteomics revolution was very seductive in that finding putative targets is relatively easy. However, what was not appreciated initially was that validating the relevance and the criticality of a target to a disease, particularly for diseases for which there are presently no good animal models or surrogate markers to monitor change in function, is far from non-trivial. As H. Stephen Wiley comments on research on epidermal growth factor receptor in his essay on systems biology, he says, "It took more than 30 years of research by thousands of scientists to accumulate enough data to start seeing the underlying patterns as scientists attempted to understand how epidermal growth factor induced cell proliferation at a systems level." He also mentioned the importance of having a sufficiently large database and high-quality data to enable predictive modeling. This comment is particularly poignant in that ERESA, for example, although originally showing efficacy in patients with non-small cell lung cancer in phase 2 studies, on which its approval for marketing was based, surprisingly failed to show survival benefit in the phase 3 trials. Tarceva, another epidermal growth factor receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitor, however, did show survival benefit. The role of EGFR mutations in patient subsets and the pharmacogenetic profile of these two agents is representative of one of the challenges genomics-based targets and a mechanism-based approach present. Another rarely mentioned challenge in drug discovery is that without structural information about the target, the scientists are not able to use in silico approaches for early lead finding. Unfortunately,
High-throughput crystallography is still developing, and information from crystallographic studies is critical to be able to design compounds in silico or to enable selection of targeted compound libraries as a starting point for screening. Therefore, the generation of data sets on classes of compounds that interact with structurally similar targets, whether they're directly or allosterically, coupled with biological response or functional data in these compounds is clearly needed. Yet another challenge is the ability to predict the metabolic and toxic effects of various structures through an understanding of off-target effects of these compounds or their metabolites. The creation of animal models, particularly for chronic and degenerative diseases, is an urgent need. The lack of these directly impacts the attrition of novel agents against unvalidated targets. This is clearly one of the reasons why there has been an increase in the attrition of compounds in clinical phase 3. A final challenge that I will mention is a regulatory challenge that would allow two or more novel agents to be studied simultaneously in a patient. The safety hurdles are considerable and clearly could not be done without the ability to predict and gather ahead of time drug-drug interactions and likely toxicities, etc. However, the reality is that in practice we use combination therapies for severe illnesses, for example, cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, congestive heart failure, etc., because these illnesses often recruit additional mechanisms that promote the deteriorating course. The advent of phase zero studies allows microdosing to test the metabolic and pharmacokinetic profile of new molecular entities. Use of nanoparticles or quantum dots could be explored to determine site of action of the agents and help determine whether these agents are interacting with their intended targets. I will now summarize what is possible in a flat world and then suggest how it could be done. The new drug discovery paradigm would then select several targets from potentially relevant pathways in a disease for drug discovery. Crystal structures of these targets or target domains would be produced. Focus libraries of chemical compounds of known biological response would be used for lead finding. Lead compounds would be used in disease models to test impact on function and physiology with respect to both efficacy and safety. Diagnostic kits would enable selection of the right patient subsets for initial efficacy trials and combination therapy of novel agents as initial approach will become rational. Clearly, to achieve this, a global effort in systems biology and systems pharmacology, in which functional relevance of pathways and targets, biological response of various molecular entities, both small molecules and proteins, and metabolic profiles of these molecular entities in well-defined patient subpopulations must be available. The world is flat. I commented at the very beginning that recognition of the fact that the world is flat will challenge cherished beliefs. A present belief in biopharm is that outsourcing to countries such as India and China will be restricted to manufacturing and routine-type operations that will not include innovation. This notion is put forward by Daniel A. Pink in his book, A Whole New Mind, in which he suggests that the left brain tasks that are routine, computer-like, are migrating to Asian economies where they are cheaper, and the right brain work that entails artistry, creativity, and empathy with the customer will remain strong in the U.S. I find it hard to believe that this will be the reality in a flat world. I do not think that American Toyota and Honda drivers would agree with this. This is clearly proven inaccurate in the IT world, where a number of these companies have evolved from being contract manufacturers to innovating their own designs. One example of this is Compal Electronics, a Taiwanese company that was founded in 1984 as a contract manufacturer and now produces its own innovative notebooks, monitors, and PDAs with annual sales of $10 billion and with branches in mainland China, South Korea, England, and the U.S. And something you do not know, that sometimes when you buy, for example, a Dell, what's in there is not Dell, but it's Compal. Similarly, Wipro, India's second largest IT company, achieved over $2 billion in sales last year. Their extended engineering model has enabled them to go from concept to market, from product strategy to hardware design and quality consulting in R&D. What is the workforce reality in China and India? According to a Duke study revealed at the end of 2005, in the areas of computer science and information technology, the U.S. had produced 137 plus thousand engineering graduates, India 112,000, and China 351,500 from their four-year schools. Although these numbers are somewhat in question, and quality of graduates is not compared, the general trend is clear. It is estimated that there are over 50 universities, 20 institutions in the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and over 800 companies in China active in molecular electronics, nanobiology, and nanomaterials. China is one of the world leaders in the number of newly registered technology firms, nanotechnology publications, and nanotech-related patents. Let us also not forget that China participated in the Human Genome Project and completed its part, namely a genetic map of chromosome 3, 2 years ahead of schedule. India is well known for its IT and statistics strength, as well as chemical manufacturing. It is estimated that outsourced R&D activities to India and China make up 20 to 30% of total global clinical trials. A number of companies do a significant part of clinical research, including trial management, data management, statistical analysis, protocol design, and final report development in India. But the world is flat, and we all can see the whole boat. In fact, with respect to health, we are all in the same boat. So I have a simple proposal. Let us not think about outsourcing that which we do not want to do in the U.S. Let us innovate in biopharm in a flat world. Let us identify therapeutic areas and develop the generation and develop and generation the required data sets on a global basis. Let us leverage the IT and nanotechnology experience and expertise of India and China to develop software and systems to validate targets. Let us leverage the expertise in the U.S. and Europe around biology and structural elucidation of targets, and let us collaborate around finding novel compounds. We could, for example, take the epidermal growth factor receptor, for which a fair amount of signaling pathway analysis has been done. One could develop a program in which, with use of model organ systems, we could seek to understand the phenotypic expression when each major enzyme in the whole system is perturbed. Another set of labs could be responsible for developing structural information on each of these critical enzymes and thus expanding the libraries of compounds that interact with them. This would enable the development of structure-activity relationships and computer-assisted design of new molecules. A third set of studies would seek to develop the activities of classes of compounds against the critical metabolizing enzymes and potential toxicities revealed. A fourth set of activities could be the genotyping of select patients to determine the presence of mutations, which could then be studied in model organisms for understanding of function and pharmacogenetics. These activities would rapidly produce the quantity that would enable mathematical modeling and prediction of structure-activity relationships. To be sure, such approaches are being attempted in distributed labs. What I'm suggesting is a human genome type effort that engages the innovative skills across the flat world. This would allow significant and rapid advances in the application of new technologies and would also enable the better deployment of those technologies. In a flat world, there is no excuse for innovating as though the hull of the boat is submerged. We can find the pre-competitive spaces where global collaboration will raise the level of all boats. I thank you for your attention.